From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And it's still unclear who's behind this weekend's massive cyber attack, which demanded ransoms in Bitcoin in exchange for data from hacked computers. Last year, the U.S. National Security Agency discovered a vulnerability in some Microsoft systems and created the hacking tool, which was stolen and used last Friday. Also last year, the Obama White House reportedly started a review of such discoveries. And there are questions today about whether the White House or the NSA should have told Microsoft sooner about their vulnerability. The BBC's tech reporter Zoe Kleinman is here. Zoe, a second wave of hacking was expected today. What happened?
So it hasn't been as widespread, the second wave, as people perhaps were predicting and fearing might happen today, as far as we know so far. What's interesting to see is that Asia and China particularly has been hit harder than people were expecting. 30,000 institutions in China, Japan, 600 firms, including big names like Hitachi and Nissan. Russia, as we know, has been the hardest hit so far. President Putin says there's been no significant damage, but the numbers there are certainly huge. The Interior Ministry, railways, banks, Megaphone, which is Russia's second largest mobile operator. There's certainly a lot of casualties ongoing. The latest figures that we have from Europol here in Europe are 200,000 victims from 150 different countries.
Amazing. And as we said, this is ransomware. So it started as a phishing email. And once it got in to people's email, it used a hacking method and then encrypted the computer systems, locking them out and demanding payment. So what are people being advised to do? Are people paying?
Well, interestingly, we haven't seen as many people paying as you might have feared. As you said, this ransomware probably would have started out as being a link in an email or something that somebody somewhere has clicked. And then it operates like a worm, which means it's able to travel through a network independently of anybody touching anything else. And any other machine that it finds that has the same vulnerability, it will just infect straight away. What it does is encrypt all your files, lock them down, and then you just get a message coming up on screen which says your files have been taken away. If you want them back, you have to pay this ransom. It's not a very big ransom, $300 in Bitcoin. We've been tracking the Bitcoin wallets. There's only been three or four different wallets that seem to have been given out as the address to deposit the ransomware demand in. And so far, there seems to be about $48,000 in them, which isn't really a huge amount of money when you think about it, possibly being $300 per computer and 200,000 victims. So most people, it seems, are not paying up.
Well, what are specialists saying? Because didn't it also warn, once it took over the computers, didn't it also warn that if people didn't pay, not only would they not get their information, you know, thousands of pages of patients' records in a hospital, for instance, not only would they not get it back, but in 7 days it would be erased?
Yeah, I mean, ransomware is a particularly nasty form of malware. And if you get it, really your best bet is to resort to backup, assuming that you are regularly backing up your data. And the interesting thing with this particular form, the WannaCry ransomware, is that people that were being asked to pay the ransom were then being told they had to contact somebody from the originators of the ransomware to get a manual key to unlock your files. Now, as you can imagine, the eyes of the world would be on whoever answers that particular phone. So it's unlikely that paying the ransom in this case would actually get your stuff back anyway, because if these people have any sense, they will totally have gone to ground, because the minute they make a move, you know, the world security agencies are out there looking for them.
Well, and to the question of, did the NSA tell Microsoft soon enough? Did the Obama administration, which was apparently collecting these examples of stolen tools, did they tell people soon enough? Is the blame squarely being placed on the NSA for not protecting those?
It's an incredibly complicated story, and I think there's going to be a lot of blame and counter-blame going on. What we do know is that the ransomware exploited a weakness in the Microsoft Windows operating system. That was a bug that had been used by the NSA as a spying tool, and it was known as Eternal Blue. And then that was leaked online in April. And ever since then, it sort of went from being a cybersecurity tool used by one government crime agency to being something that was a free-for-all that anyone who had access to the internet could get their hands on. Microsoft was aware of this, and it actually issued a patch to prevent these sorts of viruses from exploiting that bug in March, the 14th of March. So the patch has been around. I think the big question really is why it hasn't been more widely applied. You know, people are going to be asking all sorts of questions. Where does the blame lie? Does it lie with Microsoft? does it lie with the NSA? Does it lie with the IT support teams within organisations? Are they not working fast enough? Do they not have the resources to manage? I think we're going to see a lot of that coming out in the coming days. The focus so far has been on trying to contain the spread of this malware and also to try and work out, to hunt down the people that that have issued it. We don't yet know where it's come from. There are some signs that it's not particularly sophisticated malware. There are sort of signs that perhaps it's not one of the professional cyber criminal gangs that are known. And that could either make things easier because they might slip up and give the game away and, you know, make themselves known by mistake, or it might be even harder to find them because we really don't know who they are. They're not on anybody's lists.
Well, one thing we know for sure, the guy who stopped it, 22-year-old Marcus Hutchins, UK security researcher there where you are, known as Malware Tech, who just happened to register a domain name to track the virus, and he ended up stopping it, at least in one avenue. Zoe Kleinman, tech reporter with the BBC. What a story. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, the ransomware attack has caused major disruptions for people who have internet connections, but believe it or not, broadband is still an unaffordable luxury for some in this country. And a small town in northern Vermont is the latest community to organize a wireless network offering high-speed internet access at a price that low-income people can afford. John Kalish reports on the wireless mesh movement and how it hopes to address the digital divide.
Comcast is one of the largest internet service providers in the country, and it delivers cheap internet access to families in federally subsidized housing or with children in a school lunch program. But you get what you pay for.
Some ISPs do offer low-priced options, but the speeds that you're getting in those low-price options is glorified dial-up a lot of times.
In other words, way slow, says Adam Longwill. He's one of the founders of PitMesh, Pittsburgh's wireless mesh network, which has been up and running since 2013. Longwill started a company called MetaMesh to help bridge the digital divide. And one of the things it's doing is modifying Wi-Fi routers used in wireless mesh networks. One of its routers looks like a square white hockey puck. Diane Peel, a retired nurse who's helping to organize a mesh network in Newport, Vermont, bought some MetaMesh routers. Her network is centered in a neighborhood where Peel says nearly half of the kids live below the poverty line. And many don't have access to the internet at home.
In this day and age, if you can't stay connected, then you're just going to lose out. And if the kids growing up in families that the only access to the internet they ever see their parents doing is scrolling up and down Facebook on their phone, that is not preparing them to be adults in the society that we have, where they're going to go to an office somewhere, hopefully, and get a decent job and have to do more complicated things.
After a 2-year pilot project, the Newport Wireless Mesh formally launches this summer and is expected to serve about 80 families in a roughly 9-square-block area. It'll have just 6 routers, or nodes, all placed on top of participating buildings. PitMesh has 60 nodes around the city of Pittsburgh. Mesh networks are also operating in Brooklyn, Philadelphia, Detroit, Houston, and Oakland, California. Most use Wi-Fi routers that spread internet access just 200 feet.
We're hoping to have around 200 nodes at the end of the summer before the rain start.
That's Mark Yule of the People's Open Network in Oakland. Yule's a software developer who says it's not a good idea that only corporations own the infrastructure of the internet. The People's Open Network extends west across the bay to San Francisco, north to San Rafael and Marin, and south to Santa Cruz. That's made possible in part by Wi-Fi routers with directional antennas that are able to send bandwidth over long distances.
If you have line of sight and you have a good rooftop that can see other nodes far away, I would say you can get cheap hardware that will do high speeds within a few miles.
Some wireless mesh networks are financed by donations. Some are funded by voluntary payments from users. A nonprofit wireless mesh was created on Orcas Island in Washington State, and residents there pay $75 a month for internet access, but that includes paying down a loan that built the network. In Pittsburgh, mesh activist Adam Longwill says local businesses are willing to donate bandwidth to PitMesh.
A lot of times we install our devices as part of a 20 router installation project that is funded through the local community development corporation or, you know, a local nonprofit. So we basically just knock on their door and say, hey, do you want to put this router up? It's all paid for, and we'd really like you to donate bandwidth, and we'll just connect it to your internet.
The Newport, Vermont Wireless Mesh plans to run its network on a high-speed internet connection delivered via fiber optic cable. The goal is to charge low-income households $15 a month for the service, but organizer Diane Peel says some households will pay nothing and others will pay more than the $15.
We do have some people in this neighborhood who are actually somewhat better off and are very civic-minded. I'm hoping that they're going to be willing to help support the mesh and kick in a little bit more.
The wireless mesh network scene is thriving in Europe. A mesh network started in Ljubljana, Slovenia, later expanded to the rest of the country and into Croatia. For Here and Now, I'm John Kalish.
When was the last time you went on a date? And where did you meet the person? At a party? At a bar? Online? According to the Pew Research Center, 59% of U.S. adults think online dating is a good way to meet people, but only a third of those who have used a dating site have actually gone out with someone they met online. At the same time, there are more single people in the U.S. than ever, around 45% of the adult population. And more people than ever are using online dating services like Tinder, Match, eHarmony, and OkCupid. We're joined now by Michael Rosenfeld, a professor of sociology at Stanford. He studies online dating. Hi, Michael.
Good to be here.
And Whitney Wolf is also with us, CEO of the dating app Bumble. Whitney, welcome to you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And I just want to start by saying, look, we could have a whole conversation about hookup culture, but that's not what I want to do here because I think there's plenty to talk about just in terms of people who are going on these sites and these apps to date or maybe to find a long-term relationship. And I want to start with you, Michael. How common are these apps at this point in 2017? Who's using them?
So the apps are really common. Bumble is one of them. Tinder is probably the biggest one. When I talk to people who are single, who are dating, one of the things they say is that you have to use the apps because everybody else is on them. So I think for people who are looking for partners, the internet and the cell phone have displaced a lot of the old ways people used to meet. The old ways were kind of ad hoc and happenstance. You know, you meet somebody at the bar or your mom maybe knew somebody who had a kid who was your age. And
right.
It was her idea that the two of you would be perfect together, even though usually she didn't really know that other person. The internet and the phone apps give people more control. There's more potential partners online than there are at the local bar, because if you crawl over to the local bar right now, there's only five other people there.
Hmm. What are you seeing, Whitney, when you look at your data of who's using Bumble? Who's using these apps and is it changing?
You know, when I first got started in this whole world of online connecting, we were combating this antiquated stereotype of who used online dating. And we really set out to make it popular with millennials. What I find to be so fascinating now is I'm seeing an inverse in that trend. So while, for better or for worse, most everybody has tried an online dating app at this point, I think they would tell you in the, you know, 18 to 35-year-old age range. And now what I'm seeing is a new wave of kind of second-round daters joining people, you know, in my mother's group of friends, a lot of women that have gone through divorces or are ready for something new. So I truly believe that what we're seeing with online dating is very similar to what happened with the MySpace Facebook era, where MySpace was once this place for online connecting for a very select group of, you know, young people. And then Facebook kind of hit at this moment where it was acceptable for everybody to do it. And so, you know, it's a universal desire to find connections and relationships. And what better way to do that than from the palm of your hand?
And are people who are older using the apps differently than younger people?
You know, we see pretty similar usage between the age groups. Humans are humans, right? And sure, we differ as we age, and what we're looking for does change. But at the core of it, we're all really looking for the same thing. And the app allows you, regardless of age, gender, and so on, to really use it at how you wish. What's fascinating about Bumble, however, is that women make the first move, and they always do so on the app.
And that
and
why
has been
is that?
A really profound
why
thing.
Do you do it that way?
So it was really a reaction to real life versus a reaction to any other digital platform. And quite frankly, women don't hold the power when it comes to connecting. You know, in traditional antiquated dating formats, women are expected to sit on their hands and wait for the man to court them, right? And we really wanted to find a way to empower women to feel like an equal and also take away that expected aggression that men sometimes feel they have to have when it comes to this dating world.
One of the things that we know is that the apps have a reputation of promoting hookups. But if you actually look at the data, and I do, you know, long-term, longitudinal, nationally representative studies with people, I find that people who meet online are not more likely to break up. Couples who meet online aren't more likely to be hookups. In fact, couples who met through internet dating actually transitioned to marriage faster. Because there are advantages in knowing more about the person before you meet them. And if you're looking for something specific, let's say, you know, you're looking for a partner who has to be a vegan and loves to do mountain climbing, you can find that person online, but you're not going to find that person very easily in real life, because that person could walk right by you and you wouldn't know. You know, to a certain extent, dating is about information gathering, and the internet and the phone apps facilitate that to a certain degree.
Are there disadvantages in your view? Are there things that we lose because people are doing dating in this way instead of the way that they've done it in the past?
I haven't found any. The popular literature tends to view the internet dating, the phone apps, very skeptically. And I think that a lot of that skepticism is unwarranted. I think any new technology that's popular with young people is going to be viewed skeptically by the old people. And I put myself comfortably in the old people category. But the truth is that there's plenty of anecdotes about how internet dating makes people unhappy, but the data don't support those anecdotes.
I was talking to a friend recently who said that she had been on 80 first dates last year, which just seemed like a ton to me. But, you know, is that typical, Whitney? Is that typical?
Yeah, absolutely. So the beauty of Bumble and this world of online connecting is it gives you access, right? Going down to the bar, what is your access? What is the access you're gaining there? Really only a few people. And you're also in a bar, right? So you've almost set yourself up for failure from the get-go because you're surrounding yourself around something that is otherwise perceived as, you know, not the most positive thing to do. Sure, it's social, but might not be the most uplifting, right? So if you're looking for that adventuring outdoor vegan, you're probably not going to find them in the bar. So I would say this access to lots of first dates or lots of meetups is actually a really great thing because it means there's a desire to be social. There's a desire to meet people, yet the access beforehand was quite limited.
One of the things that I was reading about when it comes to online dating is that after a while, people do experience kind of a burnout or a fatigue from going through a lot of dates and having it not work out. Do you see that, Michael?
In my surveys, when we've asked people how many dates they've used the apps for in the past year, we end up with a median that's more like 3 or 4 or 5. You know, there are some people who are very goal-oriented about, I need to meet somebody and I'm just going to sort through until I find my prince or princess. But for a lot of people, the apps are sort of flirting apps more than necessarily dating apps, because the truth is arranging 80 dates is a lot of hard work.
Right.
So you have to be super...
A lot of restaurant reservations there.
Yeah, you have to be super motivated. But for most people, actually, it's sort of a more slow process, because the truth is, even with the apps, setting up a date, finding the person, getting them to agree to meet you at the place, and then, you know, going and having dinner with them, that's real work. I mean, it's always still the case that people in long-term relationships have a big advantage because the companion is immediately accessible. Everybody who's single looking to meet somebody new has work to do.
So if these apps are so great, How come more people than ever are single now? I'll let either one of you take that one.
Well, so I think there's a couple reasons. The age at first marriage in the United States has been climbing since 1960 or so. And I think the reason the age at first marriage has been climbing, people are postponing marriage, is that people can afford to be single. It used to be that if you were a woman, you had to have the support of either a husband or a father to put food on the table. You weren't going to make it in this world on your own. But that's not true anymore. People make it in this world on their own. Women can support themselves. They don't need to get married, and we're living longer. So there's less hurry to settle down. And I think the less hurry is good in a lot of ways, because a lot of the marriages that people formed when they were too young to know themselves, those marriages didn't last. I've interviewed some people who I consider to be sort of refugees from the land of committed relationships. In other words, they spent 10 years living with one or two partners, and they found how hard that could be, and they just don't want to settle down. And the truth is, you don't have to now. So we have more options. And having more options, of course, also makes it difficult to find somebody else who shares your view of relationships and commitment. So that's a challenge in the modern dating world. But more options, in my view, are almost always good.
Whitney?
I would love to agree with that, and to further that with one other point that I have seen, that people are now more willing to leave something that is not good for them. When you feel that you don't have choice or you don't have any options outside what you're already in, it's very hard to take the leap out of that, right? I do think this access that I've been talking about has granted people hope, because there is more. There are other options. Beforehand, and I remember from my college days, you know, girlfriends of mine would have boyfriends where they didn't feel like it was right, but they said, but I don't want to start going out every night. I don't want to have to go to the bar every night and meet somebody. Those days are no longer, right? You can still live your life on your own terms and have access to meeting people. And I do think that that is a positive, absolutely.
That's Whitney Wolf, who is the CEO of the dating app Bumble. We've also been speaking with Michael Rosenfeld, professor of sociology at Stanford University, who studies online dating. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks for having
me. Thank you so much.
So has online dating worked for you? Let us know at hereandnow.org.
This podcast and the following message are sponsored by Blue Apron. Blue Apron is the fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service you've heard about. Its mission is to make incredible home cooking accessible to all. They support a more sustainable food system, set the highest standards for ingredients, and make it easy and fun to cook. You decide which recipes and how many meals you want each week. Change, pause, or cancel anytime. Learn more at blueapron.com/here. Go now and get your first three meals free, plus free shipping at blueapron.com/here.
President Trump's budget director, Mick Mulvaney, spoke at Stanford University last Thursday defending the House Republicans' health care plan. And when it came to what's being called the Jimmy Kimmel test, that, as Kimmel said, no parent should ever have to decide whether they can afford to save their child's life if that child has something like the heart condition Kimmel's newborn has, Mulvaney said this.
Everybody agrees that if your kid is born with those conditions, we will come together as a community to make sure we can take care of that. But that doesn't mean that we want to take care of the person, or should be required to take care of the person, who sits home, drinks Coca-Cola, no offense, drinks sugary drinks and doesn't exercise and eats poorly and gets diabetes. Is that the same thing as Jimmy Kimmel's kid? And I don't think that it is.
Well, the diabetes community is reacting. Dr. William Cefalu is chief medical officer at the American Diabetes Association. Dr. Cefalu, your first reaction.
Well, to say that we were disappointed at Director Mulvaney's comments would be an understatement. Again, the association represents more than 29 million people living with the disease, and we took an active stance in responding to this and dispelling this comment. Unfortunately, this kind of mindset promotes the unfounded and damaging myth that getting diabetes is, in essence, a lifestyle choice.
Well, let's clarify for people. We've spoken a great deal on the program about this. We'll link you to our other stories. But there are two types of diabetes, type 1, in which the pancreas doesn't work. People can't produce insulin, has absolutely nothing to do with lifestyle. Type 2 is, though, often referred to as lifestyle diabetes. It can be triggered by poor diet. So playing devil's advocate here, Why isn't the budget director right? Force people to change their lifestyles.
Well, lifestyle certainly contributes, but even type 2 is a familial or genetic underpinning. People can be quite obese and never develop diabetes unless they have the genetic propensity for beta cell failure and not produce enough insulin. And also, there are many other forms of diabetes. There are individuals who are adults who are quite lean who develop diabetes, and they develop a type of diabetes like type 1 in the young. There is maturity onset diabetes in the young, which is genetically predisposed, and then we have the onset of type 2 in youth, which is a completely different disorder. So many of these, if not most, are genetically related. The important point is no one chooses the disease that gives them a high chance of developing blindness or kidney disease or cardiovascular disease.
Well, even if you find out you have a genetic predisposition, there are issues of education, access to good foods that many at-risk, lower-income people don't have. So a lot going on here. What, in your mind, could happen if certain kinds of diabetes are not covered?
Well, this is a chronic condition. And we do know that managing the complications and treating the blood pressure and the risk factors are incredibly important to improve quality of life and, for that matter, to reduce morbidity. So individuals who will not have the access to medications or education, this would be a problem. Uncontrolled diabetes will lead to these complications of blindness, kidney disease, and for that matter, cardiovascular and heart disease.
Well, for humanity's sake, but also for cost. I mean, if you're looking at cutting costs, it sounds like you'd only increase costs. William Cefalu, Chief Medical Officer at the American Diabetes Association. We'll continue to follow this. Thank you.
Thank you.
And to restate, there is a genetic underpinning to even the so-called lifestyle diabetes. Under Obamacare, companies cannot charge more for diabetes care. Under the Republican health care plan, they can. We will follow this story. Here,
Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan meets with President Trump at the White House tomorrow. The meeting comes at a time of tension between the two NATO allies. Erdogan has condemned the Trump administration's decision last week to arm Kurds fighting in Syria. Turkey considers that group a terrorist organization because of its ties to the outlawed Kurdish Workers' Party inside Turkey. Joining us now is Egemen Bauş. He's a senior member of President Erdogan's AKP party and a former advisor to the president. He's with us from Istanbul on Skype. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you.
And there are some who believe that President Trump should not be meeting with President Erdogan because of some of the things that Erdogan has done that don't align with American values, including mass arrests and restrictions on free expression ever since the coup attempt in Turkey. What do you say to those people?
I think they're dead wrong. President Trump should meet President Erdogan and discuss, and that's what allies do. Turkey has the second largest military in NATO after the United States. We have been allies since the Korean War. We have been fighting together against our common challenges, our common threats, our common enemies since Korea, in Kosovo, Somalia, Bosnia, Iraq, Syria, Afghanistan, all around the world. Turkey is the most dependable ally of the United States in the Middle East. On July 15th, our country went through a traumatic attempt to overthrow the democratically elected government through an undemocratic military coup. And unfortunately, that military coup was planned, organized, and executed by a terrorist organization whose head happens to be living in the state of Pennsylvania in the United States. And President Erdogan rightfully expects his allies, the Americans, to extradite that head of terrorist organization to be prosecuted in Turkey.
Do you expect that President Erdogan will push that issue with President Trump? And do you think that he will get Fethullah Gulen extradited?
I have no doubt that President Erdogan is going to raise the issue and he's going to be quite firm on this issue, because that's the expectation of every single citizen here in Turkey. 80 million Turks have not been united this much against one public enemy in the history, in the recent history of this country. Everybody wants this guy to be extradited, to be prosecuted, and to be punished. Because on one night, on July 15th, we lost more than 250 citizens who did not mind losing their lives to protect democracy, stability, and democracy of this country.
Another big issue that is sure to come up on this visit is the issue of Washington arming the Kurds, the YPG fighting in Syria, which Turkey opposes. Do you think that there's any chance that that decision will be reversed?
I'm hoping it would, because YPG is an offspring of PKK. PKK is a Kurdish Marxist-Leninist terrorist organization, and PKK happens to be on the list of terrorist organizations of the United States as well. The Obama administration, unfortunately, did not see YPG and PKK to be similar, but they had the same leadership, they have the same offices, they have the same calendar, they have the same messages. And once you give weapons to YPG, those weapons end up in the hands of PKK terrorists who are killing Turkish soldiers and Turkish citizens. The reason United States opted to work with YPG was to fight against ISIS. And we are volunteering to do the job. As we speak today, our soldiers, Turkish soldiers, are in Syria, in Iraq, fighting against the so-called Islamic State and their ridiculous leadership. And we want to do more with U.S. support and with U.S. cooperation. And this should be a fight of humanity against aggression, against those who exploit the good name of Islam. And we're willing to work with our allies, as we should. But if the Trump administration opts to choose a terrorist organization over an ally of 60 years, that's going to raise a lot of question marks in the minds of the Turkish people.
Some people may hear you say that, though, and call these parties names and think, well, this is just because President Erdogan's party doesn't like opposition.
No, we have many opposition parties, and they are very strong. And the public support for the opposition is around 48%. And the support for President Erdogan and his party has been around 52%. That was the percentage he was voted with when he was elected in 2014. So this is a democratic country. It's not one of those dictatorships where the president announces that he was elected with 96% of the popular vote. This is a real democracy. Our opposition has the chance to govern, and we have another presidential elections coming up in 2019. President Erdogan might end up losing, and we will respect the decision of the people if they choose to support another candidate. However, he is the elected president of this country, and his party has the majority in our Congress, and he is responsible to protect the safety and well-being of all of his citizens, be they voted for him or voted against him. And he's trying to do his best. It's no secret that he has tripled per capita income in this country. Since he became prime minister and president, the number of hospitals, schools, airports, water dams, infrastructure, highways have all tripled. So he has been doing good service to this country, and that's why he keeps on getting elected. But if people feel someone else might be even more successful than he is, that person might end up becoming our next president.
How would you describe Turkey's relationship with the U.S. right now, and especially with the transition from Obama to Trump?
Well, we had great hopes when Obama administration began, and unfortunately, Obama administration looked the other way for problems that required their attention. And now a very wise businessman named Donald Trump has become your new president, and he has served globally as a businessman. And in his first endeavor to run for office, he opted to run for the highest office, and he was elected by the American people. And we respect his victory. He did it. And now we're hoping that he will have the courage to deal with the problems that were neglected by the previous administration. And he will do his best to bring peace and stability to Middle East, where U.S. interests are very high, because you get most of your energy resources from the Middle East as well. And this is our backyard, if I may, because we don't want problems in our neighborhood. There's a Turkish saying, if your neighbor's house is on fire, and if you don't help him put it out, that fire might eventually burn your own home. We are trying our best to prevent the fires, to put an end to all fires in the region, to protect our own home.
I want to ask you one more question, because every so often we do a segment on our show about Turkey and what's going on in Turkey. And one of the things that we've heard a few times is that Mustafa Kemal Atatürk, the founder of modern Turkey, would be rolling over in his grave watching what President Erdogan is doing, specifically to the idea of Turkey being a secular democracy. How do you respond to people who are concerned that Turkey is becoming much more religious in a dangerous way?
I don't agree with them. Mustafa Kemal Atatürk is the founder of the modern Turkish Republic. He's a visionary leader. He is someone that we all respect. And his ideals, his vision, and his mission for his country are being carried out by President Erdogan and his team right now. He wanted an independent, strong Turkey that could stand on its own feet. And that's what President Erdogan has achieved. And only recently, yesterday, President Erdogan made a statement defending the founder of our republic, Mustafa Kemal Atatürk. And we all, be it from the government, be it from the opposition, we all have great respect. Kemal Atatürk for us is what George Washington, Abraham Lincoln, or your other founding fathers are to you. So there is no question about the respect we hold for him, and we all want to achieve his dreams. President Erdogan has, as I said, made this country much more stronger economically, democratically, socially, culturally, and he's trying his best to achieve Atatürk's dreams.
That's Egemen Bağış, who is a senior member of Turkey's ruling AKP party and a former advisor to President Erdogan. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Uber got some mixed news today about its plans for self-driving cars. A judge in San Francisco ordered that Anthony Lewandowski, the engineer leading Uber's self-driving car division, cannot work on a key part of that program. However, the program will be able to continue. The engineer is at the center of a lawsuit against Uber from Waymo, part of Google's parent company, over whether Uber stole self-driving car technology. Meanwhile, we got word yesterday that Waymo will now team up with Uber's competitor, Lyft, to test driverless car technology. So lots to talk about in the world of ride-hailing companies and self-driving cars. Derek Thompson is senior editor at The Atlantic. He joins us from New York. Hi, Derek.
Hey, Jeremy.
And first, let's talk about this news today from Uber, or about Uber, from this judge in San Francisco. Tell us more.
Sure. This is not good for Uber at all. Mike Isaac from The New York Times has been all over this story. Let's work through the TikTok a little bit. First, you have Anthony Lewandowski, who is one of the most famous people in self-driving car technology, used to work at Google. He leaves Google to start his own self-driving unit. That unit is acquired by Uber, so he now works for Uber. Waymo from Google, that's the name of Google's self-driving car division, they sue Lewandowski. They say, when you left, you stole our proprietary information to start your own company, which is now owned by Uber. So Uber essentially has stolen our technology. And now you have this judge saying that indeed Lewandowski is not allowed to work on self-driving cars as long as the litigation is pending. So that in and of itself would be pretty bad news for Uber, especially considering all the other bad stuff that's been going on with all their accusations of personnel problems. But now Uber's chief competitor in car hailing networks, Lyft, is teaming up with its chief competitor in the software for self-driving cars, Google. So now I think Uber really is in a bind here. They are prevented from having their top talent being able to work on the technology while their two closest rivals move one step forward toward this stuff.
Well, why is that deal between Waymo and Lyft happening now?
So self-driving cars, I think it sounds like one big thing, but it's best understood as three big things: the hardware, the software, and the network. The hardware is the car itself, the shell, the body of the car itself. The software is what allows that car to drive itself. And the third, the network, that's Uber, that's Lyft. That's one company owning the capacity to connect those who wish to be driven and the cars themselves.
And the big news here is that Google, which is one of the leaders when it comes to the tech, the software, is connecting with Lyft, which is the number two largest sort of ride hailing company in the country after Uber. And so what this would allow them to do, it would allow them to work together on pilot projects and product development efforts and potentially get one step closer toward actually realizing this thing that we've been talking about for so long, which is a network of self-driving cars that could be hailed with the press of a button, essentially something owned either by a company like Google or even by a municipality.
It does make you wonder, though, why they need the Lyft partnership. Why doesn't Waymo just form its own company for ride hailing to go up against Uber and Lyft? It seems like that's the easiest thing to mimic. The software is probably harder.
Sure. I think that's a perfectly valid point. And again, right, there are three parts to self-driving: the hardware, the car, the software, the self-driving tech, and the network itself. Here's the thing. Networks are theoretically easy to build products for, but it's actually very difficult, right, to get tens of millions of people on your product, and particularly to get that product to work well. You know, Lyft has had years to perfect it. Uber has had years to perfect it. These are popular products. And so what Google might be thinking, and again, Waymo is a subsidiary, essentially, of Google and Google's parent company, Alphabet. What they're thinking is, it might be cheaper in the short term to essentially piggyback off of a network that already exists as we're sort of experimenting with pilot projects and product development efforts. I do anticipate that the most value will come from connecting these three things, from connecting the hardware, software, and network. And so eventually, yes, Google, Waymo might decide that what they want to do ultimately is to build their own network that competes with both Uber and Lyft. But in the short term, it might make the most sense, at least in terms of getting these cars on the market, trying them out, making sure they actually work,
right,
to just piggyback off of a huge network that already exists.
Derek, I imagine there are some Uber and Lyft drivers listening to us right now wondering, when am I going to be out of a job because they're going to turn these Ubers and Lyfts into self-driving cars? Do we have a sense of the timing?
No, we don't have a sense of the timing, really. I mean, it's clearly not months. It's clearly a matter of years. The question is it 5 years or is it 15 years? There are a lot of questions that we don't have the answers to that stand in the way of today, when self-driving cars are merely projects in Phoenix and Pittsburgh, and when self-driving cars are, in fact, you know, 10, 20, 50% of the fleet.
Right.
You have regulation that stands in the way, government regulation. You have popular perception of the safety of these cars. You know, right now, when there's a car accident that is human, that's a human's fault, it's not necessarily a national story. But when it's a self-driving car's fault, we hear about it. So a lot of stuff stands in the way.
Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic. Derek, thank you.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.